You can open your Bible once again to Ruth chapter 3. This will be actually the first part of a two-part message. So we'll be having the message today. Next Sunday will be Christmas, a Christmas message. Then we'll have another message that I won't be here on the 26th, another message I won't be here on the 2nd. And then usually I do a New Year's message after that. So the next time we're in Ruth will be like a month or so from now. But just try to keep in mind that this is just the first part of the message on Ruth chapter 3. Some of you probably have interesting stories regarding how you got engaged. Perhaps you had a really romantic setting at a beach or maybe at a starlight evening or maybe a really beautiful candlelight dinner or something like that. And you set it all up very romantically where, you know, the fella got down on one knee and he had this beautiful diamond and he proposed and all this stuff. Some of you proposed rather recently, I understand. So this is a very recent thing that has happened. Some of you maybe have vague recollections of how that happened many years ago. For me, I got engaged sort of romantically. It was July the 4th, right after the fireworks. So we saw the fireworks, and then I brought out the ring and engaged. I was down on one knee. And I thought it was about as romantic as I can get, you know, given the circumstances and the kind of person I am. It was a little bit romantic, I suppose. So she said yes. I guess that's all that really matters. But, you know, the Bible gives a bunch of different examples of how people found a mate. You could follow the example of Adam and just sort of wait around until God brings you a woman. You could maybe follow the example of Isaac. You remember how Isaac got a wife? Isaac's dad sent a servant back to his hometown and found a girl who was willing to water his camels. So you could, you know, ask your dad to send somebody back to your hometown and find a girl who's willing to, you know, water your camels. That's kind of an unusual way to do it. Or you could do like what Ruth did here, as we'll find. Ruth lay down at the feet of a prospective husband at night, went to where he was sleeping and laid down and waited for him to tell her what to do. Well, I wouldn't necessarily follow that example either. I wouldn't suggest that that's the right way to find a mate. But it worked for Ruth, and we'll be looking at this plan, this what I think is a kind of a perilous plan that Naomi put into action that eventually led to the marriage of Ruth and Boaz. Well, remember that the theme of the book is how God demonstrates his faithfulness by loving, superintending, and caring for his people. Ruth chapter 3 demonstrates how God is going to provide a home and security for Ruth and Naomi. And he's going to do this through, or maybe even in spite of, this perilous plan, this scheme that Naomi has put together, is going to work in the long run to bring Ruth and Boaz into contact and into a marriage. But it is a rather perilous plan, as we will see. We should also note that this passage uses these two very important words that we talked about last time, both goel, the kinsman redeemer or the near kinsman, and the word hesed, the word for love or mercy or kindness. Both of these very critical words are used in this passage, and we will note them as we go along. But today we'll look at Naomi's perilous plan to provide security for Ruth. So first of all, we'll notice that Naomi hatches this plan. Notice verses 1 through 4. We've already read this passage, but notice in verse 1, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said, "My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee?" Now you might think, well, she's been working out in the field, and so she needs a little rest. That's not exactly the rest that she's talking about. Here, Naomi is talking about a marriage, rest in the sense of security, comfort, a place of peace and security. That's what the word rest means in this case. And that would mean that Naomi is seeking a marriage partner for Ruth. The way that Ruth, as a widow at this time, the only way that she could have security and a place of peace and contentment would be for her to get remarried. And so Ruth, remember, is with Naomi, and Naomi is the mother-in-law. She's the older widow. And because Naomi is the mother-in-law, she feels responsible to take care of Ruth. Although Ruth has been kind of taking care of her along the way here for the last several months, probably as Ruth was out in the fields gleaning, now Naomi feels like she's got to take care of Ruth and give her a permanent place of security. Now, why would marriage be in the best interests of Ruth? Remember that Ruth is a young woman, but she's a widow. And as a widow, she has left her home. She's moved back to Bethlehem with Naomi. And Ruth basically doesn't have any viable means of support. They've been doing the gleaning thing here in the harvest time, but that's only just a few weeks out of the year, maybe a couple of months, where they can go out into the fields and glean and get essentially free food. But now the harvest is over. So what are a couple of destitute widows going to do to keep themselves together? How are they going to have any kind of income? What are they going to do? They are not married. Their husbands have died. They don't really have family support. They're destitute. They're facing poverty. And so really the best case scenario, the best option would be for Ruth to get married and find somebody who's going to take care of her. So that's what she proposes. She wants to find a husband for Ruth. So she comes up with this plan. She intervenes, you might say, in the life of Ruth to try to find a mate for her. You know, we all benefit from the intervention of people on our behalf. Ruth here has a benefactor. Naomi is going to go to bat, or she's going to do something nice. She's going to try to do something nice for Ruth, try to intervene on her behalf. One of the ways that God provides for us, even today, is through the work of other people. Other people intervene for us to do nice things for us. And it's really important that we develop relationships, networks of friends and acquaintances and colleagues who, when we need something, who can intervene for us, when they can maybe recommend us for a job or suggest something to us or help us out in various ways. It's always nice to have people who are willing to go to bat for you, willing to give a good word, maybe give a recommendation, maybe help you in some way or the other. It's wonderful to have networks of friends that you know that you can count on to help you with a recommendation or help you with an introduction. I mean, all things considered, I never would have found my wife except for the introduction that her uncle gave. Her uncle was my teacher at Detroit Seminary, and he happened to just think of me when he was thinking of his single niece down in South Carolina, and he's the one who sort of brought us together. So without the intervention of my wife's uncle, I never would have met my wife, and who knows what my life would have been had I not met her. So life can go in a totally different direction depending upon the interventions that other people can do for us. Well, all of us have ways that we can work for the benefit of others. In this case, Naomi is working for the benefit of Ruth. Previously, Ruth had worked for the benefit of Naomi. So maybe we can think of different ways that we could do something like this, intervene on behalf of somebody else, a needy person. In this case, Ruth needed a husband, and so Naomi is going to do something. Well, maybe there are people around us. Well, maybe that somebody needs a husband or a wife. My wife and I sometimes kick around or joke around about this idea of creating a website. We would call it Quality Christian Singles, because both of us know a number of people who are single who seemingly would make very good mates, but for whatever reason, they've not gotten married. When I got married to my wife, she was one of several single, young, sharp women teachers at the school where my wife was teaching. And I kind of swooped in and, you know, claimed the pick of the litter when I got my wife. But actually, there were probably 6 or 8 other very sharp, godly, young women who were part of that part of the staff at that school, any one of which would have made a very nice wife for any guy. But for whatever reason, I don't think any of the other ones that used to work with my wife, I don't think any of the rest of those ladies ever got married. And now I think they're approaching their 40s, maybe a little bit older than that. And the prospects for them getting married are not so great. So that's why we need to make a website, you know, for these quality Christian singles who we could match up with other quality Christian singles who are looking for husbands or wives as well. You know, all things being equal, happiness, security, and stability stem from marriage. One of the greatest blessings of life is a good marriage. Now, I know a bad marriage can be a real burden, but a good marriage, a good relationship with your spouse can be a real blessing. It's appropriate to seek marriage for yourself or for a loved one. It's appropriate for parents to seek a good marriage partner for their children. In this case, it was the mother-in-law seeking a marriage for her daughter-in-law. But the idea of parents seeking a good marital situation for a child is a very good thing. I think probably most of us as parents, if we have young children, we think about and we pray for the spouse for those children. We want them to have a godly and good and sharp, you know, person to marry, and that is that's a burden that we want to see fulfilled, that we want them to enjoy that part of life. Unfortunately, many in modern culture tell us that marriage is not necessary for a fulfilling and meaningful life. Marriage restricts you, they tell us, and prevents us from having freedom and achieving things in our life. Single people, they say, have more freedom and more fun. Single people aren't tied down to their families and their homes. They can come and go as they please. They can enter into relationships and exit relationships. They can just have a lot of fun and do their own thing. But, you know, oftentimes single people who seemingly have a lot of fun and maybe are achieving a lot of things in the business world or making a lot of money or, you know, whatever they're doing as a single person, even though they're not tied down by the burdens of family life, oftentimes these people are really lonely and they really desire to be married, but for one reason or another, they can't find the right person, or they've just convinced themselves that life is going to be a lot better being single than what it would be being married. Well, I think that family life is a lot more of a blessing than the freedoms or the so-called privileges that a person has by being single. If you do find the right mate, marriage is a great blessing. Lack of marriage, frankly, is part of the problem in our culture. It's not part of the solution. It used to be years ago, 100 years ago, there was a really promotion of marriage. Most people, when they came into their adult years, they got married. They had family. They had kids. And that was a good thing. You know, culture, society, our entire nation is founded upon families. And the stronger these families are, the stronger the nation is. But as you probably know today, family life is really breaking up in so many ways. And so it's very unfortunate that so many people today think that they're better off not getting married. They can do better in the business world. They can have more fun, more excitement, more achievement by not getting married. Well, I think the biblical truth is that rest, peace, security, happiness, comfort, all those things are directly related to marriage. A good marriage can be a real benefit for virtually anybody. Proverbs 18:22 says, he who finds a wife finds what? Remember the language there? He that findeth a wife findeth a good thing. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. So Naomi knew that. Naomi knew that Ruth would be better off, better served, not being just this destitute, single widow lady for the rest of her life, but instead getting married. So she had to find Ruth a suitable mate, and it seemed as if there were a particular candidate that was on the radar screen here. Maybe somebody that they knew would be a particularly good candidate. So Naomi comes up with this plan. Notice verse 2. She mentions the target. Who's the target for this plan? Now is not Boaz of our kindred with whose maidens thou wast? In other words, Ruth has been gleaning during the entire barley and wheat harvest with the servants of Boaz out in the field, gleaning this grain and bringing it home. So they had a means of sustaining themselves. They had enough food. And she's been doing this now for several weeks during this entire harvest time. And so Naomi thinks, you know, Boaz has shown some kindness to you, shown some interest. Maybe he would be the type of a guy who would be a good partner for you. Notice also the language here where she says in verse 2, is not Boaz of our kindred? Not only is Boaz part of the family, the clan, the tribe, but notice what Naomi says here, of our family, of our kindred. She's including Ruth in with her family. Now remember, Ruth is only related to the family by marriage. And it's only because of her now deceased husband that she's considered part of this clan. So when Naomi says our kindred, she's really being very generous and kind here, including Ruth in with the rest of the family, when in reality her connection to the family is very tenuous. It's only through marriage of her now deceased husband. So I think can give credit here for that kind of language. She's including Ruth along with the rest of the family, saying you are part of our family. And that's kind of a nice thing for her to say. She says that Boaz is going to be winnowing barley that evening. So here's an opportunity that Naomi sees to see if Boaz will play the part of the Goel, the near kinsman, the kinsman redeemer who could solve all their problems, basically. If he would do the work of this Goel, then that would solve a lot of their problems, especially for Ruth. So is he going to do that? He'll be doing the winnowing process at the threshing floor. Now, for those of us who are not farmers, what is winnowing? Well, winnowing is the process of removing the chaff from the grain. Today it's all mechanized, but in the old days you had to do it by hand. They would beat the grain with a flail or with maybe animals, and eventually that would separate the chaff from the grain of wheat or barley or whatever it was. And then they would take it to the threshing floor. And the threshing floor, for some reason, I always had it in my head that this was like a wooden structure, a floor that somebody had put together and built out of wood. But typically, this would be just a flat, hard spot, maybe even a rock. Generally speaking, the threshing floor would be maybe on a hill where it got a constant breeze. And sometimes they would do this during the evening, because the evening breezes were a little less gusty than the rest of the day. And so typically in the afternoon or evening, they'd start the winnowing process, and they would throw this material up into the air. The wind would come along, take away the chaff, and it would leave the grain. So as you imagine, this was a fairly, you know, labor-intensive process. If you had piles and piles of grain, it would take you a long time to do this. And so you'd have usually a lot of people out there doing this, and then there might be some celebrations at the end of this time. And so that seems to be what's going on here. Harvest time is often associated with celebration and feasting. And so Naomi knows that Boaz and his family and friends are going to have probably a meal there. They'll do the winnowing process, probably a bunch of people involved with that. They'll have a big meal. They'll have a good time, kind of a celebration here at the end of the harvest, and then he'll probably go to sleep there. So what does she advise that Ruth does? She says in verse 3, "Wash thyself therefore, and anoint thee." The word here, anoint, probably is talking about some sort of a fragrant oil, probably an olive oil that's been perfumed. "And put thy raiment upon thee." Now the raiment is the cloak or the outer coat. Now she's going to say to go into the threshing floor or go where the grain is and lie down and basically spend the night out there. This would be out in the open, probably not in a barn, but out in the open. And so obviously she needs an outer garment. And this is not dressing up necessarily. This is not putting on your best clothes, because remember, this is happening at night. So it's not like Ruth is dressing to impress or entice Boaz. She simply needs an outer garment because it's going to be a little bit chilly that night. So take along your outer garment, put it on, or take it with you and go out into the threshing floor. Speaking of dress, it's kind of interesting to consider the dress. Some of the commentators noted that probably up until this time, because Naomi says, "Wash yourself, anoint you, and put on your raiment," the possibility exists that Ruth had been dressing as a widow up until this point. Now, in that culture, if you were mourning for the loss of a spouse, you would dress as a widow or a widower. And typically, I think in our context, you know, if a person is always dressing in black and their spouse has just passed away, we recognize that they're in mourning. But in this context, a person like a widow could dress as a mourning widow for a long time. And so for Naomi to say, "Wash yourself, put on this perfumed ointment, put on your cloak," it's almost as if she's saying, put off your widowing clothes and put on your normal clothes. The time of your widowhood now is over. You've grieved over the loss of your dead husband. Okay, that's over now. And now you need to put on your regular clothes and go out and do this that I'm advising you to do. And so it could be, some people speculate that maybe one of the reasons that Boaz had not really pursued Ruth up until this point, other than being kind and generous in the field, the reason that he really hadn't shown much romantic interest in Ruth, perhaps, is because she's continually dressing like a widow in mourning for her dead husband. Well, it's just not good form to show romantic interest in a woman who's dressing like a widow who's mourning her dead husband. You just didn't do that. So Naomi is suggesting here, put off your widow's garments, anoint yourself with oil or perfumed oil, which you wouldn't do as a widow, and then go and see Boaz. So it seems as if, you know, that's what's going on here. She's showing that her widowhood is over. She's ready to get back to normal life, and normal life in this case would include getting married. So she's supposed to go on here in verse 4. "It shall be when he lies down that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in and uncover his feet and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do. So why would Boaz be sleeping at the threshing floor? Why would a guy like Boaz, remember Boaz is a wealthy man, he's a highly respected, virtuous man in the community, no doubt he had a nice home to go back to, why in the world would he be out there on the threshing floor sleeping by these piles of grain? You would think that a rich man like him might have servants to do that for him. Well, I think this shows that Boaz is just a man of the field. He's just a regular farmer, nothing extra special about him. He's not an elitist. He's not somebody who doesn't get his fingernails dirty. He's out there working with the rest of the people. And for him, as a farmer, he's out there protecting his crops. Remember that this is at the harvest time. This is at the end of this long process that leads to the having the grain ready to eat or to grind or, you know, whatever they do next with the grain. So the process of bringing in the harvest and everything, by this time, this material, this grain, is worth a lot of money. They've expended a lot of effort to get this grain harvested. So he wants to be there, sleeping there and watching over that grain so that nobody steals it or that perhaps, you know, wild animals don't come in and eat it. He's got a lot invested in this harvest, and so he's out there as a farmer would do. Even though he's a wealthy and powerful man, still he's a man of the field, he's a man of the earth, and so he's out there watching his harvest. Now, what does it mean when she says, uncover his feet? As you might imagine, there's a lot of discussion in the commentaries about this phrase. What does it mean that Ruth is to go and uncover the feet of Boaz? And although the phrase uncover the feet is used several different times in the Bible and it means other things in other places, here it actually means uncover his feet or perhaps his lower limbs, his lower extremities, maybe up to his knees or something like that, to uncover. So the idea would be that Boaz would lie down, go to sleep, and then Ruth would come along and basically uncover his feet so that he'd be uncomfortable, at least at some point in the night. He would wake up. And lo and behold, then he would find Ruth lying at his feet. So that seems to be the only idea that's being communicated here of uncover his feet is to do just that, uncover his feet. And then what she's expecting to happen at the end of verse 4, he shall tell thee what thou shalt do. So this whole plan revolves around Boaz's response. Boaz is supposed to wake up, find Ruth there, and then know what to do. Okay? So Naomi was sure that when Boaz saw Ruth, he would do the proper and suitable thing. All of this depends on Boaz's good character and wisdom. That's why this is a rather delicate and dangerous plan, because we don't know how Boaz is going to respond. What's going to happen when he wakes up and finds Ruth lying there? Naomi seems to be confident that Boaz will do the right thing. He's proven himself to be a good and a godly man, a man of virtue. He's got a good reputation. People trust in him. He was not like so many others of that era. Remember that this is during the time of the judges. And what do we know about the moral quality of the people around this time? Everybody did what? That which was right in his own eyes. So there are a lot of people who are not following God's law. And if Boaz had been a person of low character, well, this widow woman who's not under anybody's protection shows up at night in a private location where a man is sleeping. What is he supposed to think? What is he supposed to do? Well, a man of low character might do any number of things. But Naomi trusts that Boaz is a man of high character. And even though given the opportunity to do something potentially immoral here, Naomi believes that Ruth is in good hands, that Boaz will know the right thing to do. So she has confidence in Boaz. He will tell Ruth what to do next. He would do the right thing. Well, I wonder if people today have the same confidence in us. If we were facing a delicate situation, could we be trusted to do the right thing? That is, do we have a reputation for honesty and integrity? And even if you had the opportunity to do something wrong, people know that, well, you would not do the wrong thing. Even if the temptation came to you, you would still do the right thing. You have virtue and integrity. Could you be trusted to behave yourself properly in a situation like this? You know, some men would have taken advantage of Ruth And frankly, there was not a lot that Ruth could have done because Ruth was not protected by any man. She was not married. She didn't have brothers. She didn't have uncles. She didn't have anybody other than Naomi. A man of low character could have abused or taken advantage of Ruth on this situation. Well, I hope that people have confidence in us, that when we have the opportunity to do the right thing or the wrong thing, that we choose to do the right thing. I trust that people have confidence in us that we are people of honor and virtue. People hopefully don't have any doubts as to what we would do in a precarious situation like this. I trust that all of us would behave ourselves with virtue and with propriety. Maybe you heard the story of this man who was working at a church recently. He's a plumber, and behind one of the walls of this place where he was working, I guess behind a toilet or something like that, he found $600,000 worth of checks and cash. Have you heard about that in the news recently? Well, had this man, well, fortunately, I should say, the man was a man of character, at least some character. He told the church that he had found this money that apparently had been stolen several years previous, and somehow people think that maybe the thief put it up in the, like a drop ceiling, and somehow it made its way down the wall. Nobody knows exactly how the money got where it got to, but the man found $600,000 worth. A lot of that was in checks, but some of it was in cash. Now, I don't know exactly what the circumstances were, but if the man was working by himself, well, what could he have done? He could have just taken that cash, pocketed it, put everything back where it was, sealed everything up, and said nothing. Nobody would have been the wiser. Nobody would have known anything about it, and he would have been many thousands of dollars ahead. Well, as it turns out, he turned in all the money, and the church gave him a $20,000 reward for that, so he came out well in the end. But I'm wondering how much he could have gotten away with had he just not said anything about it. And so there are times in life when situations like that happen, where we have the opportunity either to do right or wrong, good or bad. It's the virtue, it's the character, it's the morality of the person that determines what they're going to do in any situation. And so I trust that all of us are people of virtue who would do the right thing in that kind of a delicate situation where really you could do the wrong thing and nobody would know. And let me just give you another story that happened to me recently. I don't want to use myself as an example necessarily, but it's an interesting story that I want to tell. The other day I was sitting in the office, and a man came to the door, a man who I don't know, a man who I've never seen before, and he asked, "Does your church support missionaries?" And I said, "Yes, we've got a missionary board here. We've got probably at least a dozen or so missionaries that we support regularly." He said, "Okay, good. I like to support missionaries." And he reached into his pocket and he gave me $1,000 in cash. $1,000. Some of us haven't ever seen $1,000 all in one spot. But he took out a little thing, a big roll of bills, $1,000, handed it to me. They're all 50s. And said, "Here, give this to the missionaries, or, you know, if there's a person in need, you know, whatever you think would be best. But I'd like to support the missionaries or somebody in need during this season." And then he walked out. I said, "Well, do you want to tell me your name, who you are, or why you're giving this money?" He said, no, I'd rather just remain anonymous. And he turned around and left. So, I don't know, that's never happened to me ever in my entire life, in my ministry of several decades. Nobody has ever come into my office and given me $1,000 in cash. Well, of course, my immediate thought was, I got to put this money in the bank. I don't want $1,000 in cash laying around here. So I went to the bank and deposited it. But, you know, afterwards I began thinking, I could have done anything with that $1,000. I got a few things I wouldn't mind buying for $1,000. $1,000 cash, the guy was, he was anonymous, he was gone. He didn't know how I handled that money. He didn't know what I did with it. Nobody else knew. Nobody was here other than me. So I easily could have pocketed that $1,000. But I'm telling you now that I didn't. You can look in the records. The bank has a $1,000 deposit on the day that guy gave me the money. But, and I'm not saying this, oh, look how virtuous I am. I'm just saying that all of us face opportunities like that. It might not be somebody gives you $1,000 to give to something else, but it may be a situation, well, where, I could have taken half of that money and deposited the rest. I could have, you know, any number of things. So all of us have situations, well, I can do the right thing or the wrong thing here. I can do what's honest and virtuous or something that's kind of underhanded and shady. And the only thing that's going to make the difference, really, is your own inner personal character. Nobody else knows, only you and God. So in this case, Naomi believed that Boaz, even in that kind of a dicey situation where he's alone with Ruth in a very private location at night and she's laying there, and what is she trying to say? What is she offering here? What exchange is she trying to make? Well, Naomi believes that Boaz is the kind of man who's going to understand. He's not going to take advantage of Ruth. He's not going to press his advantage on her. And so all of us need to consider, are we the kind of people that have that inner integrity and honesty that if we were facing that kind of a dicey situation or kind of a situation where we could do either evil or right, that we're going to choose to do the right thing. Nobody's perfect, and even King David, when given the opportunity to do wrong, he took that opportunity, as we know. And many, many people fail. We all fail in many ways. We all stumble, the Bible says, in many ways. So I'm not saying that, you know, every single time that temptation comes along, we avoid it. But hopefully, if we are people of integrity and honesty and virtue, when given the opportunity to do something wrong, we don't. We do the right thing, just like we find in Boaz's life. Well, finally then, as we go on, number two, Ruth agrees to follow the plan. Verses 5 and following, she said unto her, all that thou sayest unto me, I will do. She went down to the floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law told her. So she goes down to the threshing floor and finds it just exactly as Naomi told her it was going to be. Boaz comes in after this long day of work. He's had this evening meal. He goes over to the piles of grain and he lies down. And notice in verse 7 it says, when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn or grain. And she came softly and uncovered his feet and laid her down. Now it says, when Boaz had eaten and drunk. That doesn't mean that Boaz was intoxicated here. Probably he had some celebration. He had a big meal with his family and friends. This is at the end of the harvest. So no doubt there was some merrymaking. No doubt there was some celebration. But it doesn't indicate here that he was intoxicated. Remember that Boaz is a man of virtue and integrity. He's got a high reputation. So it's highly unlikely that he'd be getting drunk. So, you know, we shouldn't think that of him. But Ruth went in, uncovered his feet, laid down. It says softly. She came in softly here, secretly, privately, so that nobody else knew what she was doing. And she lay down at his feet. And just as Naomi planned in verse 8, it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid, probably had a bad dream of some sort. He woke up, probably because, again, his feet were uncovered and he was uncomfortable. He turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And, of course, he questions, who art thou? So this is really the high point or the hinge upon which the whole rest of the story turns. How will Boaz respond to what Ruth is doing here? Ruth's future depends upon how Boaz will respond. Bible students have long realized that Naomi's plan is a bit of a gamble here, to say the least. Who's to say that Boaz would understand what Ruth is asking for? Waking up in the middle of the night to find a foreign female lying at your feet, well, Boaz easily could have misunderstood this whole situation. What is Ruth suggesting by meeting him privately in a situation like this? This could have been a huge disaster for both Ruth and Boaz. It could have turned out badly had Boaz not responded properly. Had Boaz not been a man of good character and virtue, Ruth might have been in real danger here. So that's why I say that this is kind of a perilous plan. One of the writers put it this way, the first scene closes, leaving us to wonder if this delicate and dangerous plan will work. I think if we put ourselves in this situation, it really is kind of a dangerous plan. One writer called Naomi's plan here, faith-filled but folly-laden. It's kind of a scheme to put it all together. But it really puts Ruth in a kind of a dangerous place. Well, that's where we're going to leave the characters for today. This is, as I said, part one of a two-part message. And so we're going to leave everything sort of hanging in suspense. Boaz has woken up. He's found Ruth at his feet. Basically, he'll go on to ask who you are. But how is he going to respond? Is he going to respond properly, as Naomi believes that he will, or is he going to come to some other conclusion? Well, we'll have to wait and see and come back next time about 4 or 5 weeks from now, where we'll be back in the book of Ruth. And of course, you can just go on and read the text to find out what happens if you're not sure. Until next time, let's consider then how we should intervene on behalf of somebody else who is in need. We don't have to develop schemes like this one to help other people, dangerous or sort of perilous schemes to help other people. But maybe we could intervene. Maybe we could make a recommendation. Maybe we could make an introduction. Maybe we could send an email or a text to help somebody in need. Maybe there's somebody that you know who frankly needs a mate, and you could play the part of the matchmaker. Well, people have to do that occasionally, and oftentimes that can be very successful. It worked in my case and my wife that somebody brought us together, and maybe you could do the same for somebody else. So think about whom you could help this coming week. Maybe as you look ahead and think about your appointments and people that you'll be meeting, people that you know, who could you help with a recommendation? Who could you help, just a word of encouragement, or maybe just a introduction? Hey, maybe if I introduce this guy to this girl, or introduce this person, this employer to an employee, or you know, maybe I could help with helping people to make the introductions and the connections that they need. Maybe we could do that. Think about that this coming week. And then let's also consider whether we are the kind of people with the inner personal character and virtue that allow other people to trust in us implicitly, that we will do the right thing, even given the opportunity to do wrong. There should be no doubt in the people's minds, in anybody's mind, that we are trustworthy and virtuous people. There should be no question about how we would respond in a delicate and even a dangerous situation. We should be people of integrity and virtue that other people trust to do the right thing, just like Naomi trusted Boaz. Well, let's have a word of prayer.